Welcome to Viva la Vulva, the podcast that explores and teaches about the goodness of the vulva. Here is your host, Dr. Kara Quant, an internal medicine doctor and advocate for female sexual health.
Hello, and welcome to the Viva la Vulva podcast. I am your host, Dr. Kara Quant, and I'd like to thank you for joining me today. Today is a special day. I have a special guest on the podcast, and she goes by Dr. Alexandra Stockwell, who is a doctor and intimacy coach, and we are going to dive into conversation about intimacy in long-term relationships. Thank you, Dr. Alexandra Stockwell, for being on the podcast. And also want you to introduce yourself to the audience.
Thank you, Dr. Kara. I really love what you do. And I particularly love that as an internal medicine doctor, you're really addressing sexual health head on in this way and indirectly and all the different ways you do. So that's so good. Yeah. So let's see. 1993, I'm 54 years old. So in 1993, I started medical school. I met my husband the first week of medical school. And the first 10 years of our personal and professional life together consisted of medical school, residency training. We got married second year, and I had my first child at the end of my third year of medical school and second child just before my internship. And so the thing I want to say is that the first 10 years of my life was just of our relationship, not of my life. The first 10 years of our relationship, we just were so busy and testing often and working 70, 80, 90, occasionally 100 hours a week, changing diapers. And I love being a doctor. My training is in family medicine, and I love my husband. And I just thought that after we had more time together, our sex life would really open up and expand because my focus was on medicine. So I'm introducing myself, but I'm also saying how I come to be doing what I'm doing. And
yeah,
10, 12 years in, we had most weekends off, our evenings off. We didn't have babies in diapers at that time. We do have four children, but we had a gap. So that was the case that there were no diapers to change. And we had more time together, and that really didn't change much in our sex life, which was happening. It was functional. It wasn't bad, but it wasn't anything the poets write about. I didn't feel like this erotic communion that I had thought we should, because we really loved one another. So I loved practicing medicine. I wasn't burnt out. That's a phenomenon now. But when I took a sabbatical and then didn't go back from practicing medicine, I didn't know anyone who'd stepped away from medicine except for accident or addiction or illness. In other words, it was always involuntary. But I really, as I say, I loved practicing medicine, but there was like a whisper inside, and I needed to figure out more deeply who I am and how I want to serve. And so there are a lot of different steps along the way, conventional training, unconventional trainings. And now I don't practice medicine anymore at all. I have a virtual practice. I've been working on Zoom since long before the pandemic. I used to meet new clients and say, have you ever heard of Zoom? And I do not ask that question anymore.
Yeah.
And I'm an intimate marriage expert, a relationship and intimacy coach, and I mostly work with successful, educated couples who are committed to one another, who want to be with one another, and sometimes there are communication issues, but more often they have what I describe as conflict-free, passion-free relationships. So that's the broad strokes of who I am and what I bring to the conversation.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you again for joining the Viva La Vulva podcast. And yes, let's dive into it because I feel like I have a lot of questions about intimacy in marriage and long-term relationships. I actually just recently got married. And so I have, you know, questions, and I'm sure, you know, the listeners out there also can't wait to hear the stuff that you do and the advice that you can impart. So let's dive into it. So actually, the first question that I had, kind of going off of the questions that I created, is about intimacy. And if you can explain intimacy when it comes to the context of marriage and long-term relationships.
Yeah, I really love starting with that question. And let me just say, congratulations. I think you're in such an exciting phase of life. And it's so beautiful, the intentionality that you bring right from the get-go. I think that's super smart, and many could learn from that. Intimacy, I think it's generally not well understood. There's the simple matter of many people thinking it's a synonym for sex. And of course, it can include sex, but it really doesn't. I think it's super helpful to distinguish types of intimacy, and different people split it up into different numbers, different kinds of intimacy. But the main ones that I really focus on are emotional intimacy, sensual intimacy, and erotic intimacy. And I think to really have long-term passion, each of those, whether or not you distinguish them linguistically, they each need their own attention. Emotional intimacy being obviously in the realm of the emotions and communication and the way things feel. Sensual intimacy really related to the experiences in all five senses and the way that they blend together and how you share that with someone. And then erotic intimacy, obviously having more to do with sexual chemistry, and you can be touching one another, or you can be across the room from one another, what that actually looks like. But there's definitely a pulsing and a whole other energy. So the additional thing I want to say is that something very common, especially in more, I don't know if new age is the term people use anymore, but like in circles where this would be a question, people really enjoy the definition, into me you see, intimacy, meaning into me you see. And I think that that's cute and actually very unhelpful for the following reason. When you think of intimacy as being seen, into me you see, it puts the focus of creating intimacy on the other person. And I think it is much more helpful in creating closeness, connection, juicy communion, to really think of intimacy as the act of revealing who you are. So yes, then the other person can see you, but it's the act of revealing who you are, what is in your heart, what is in your mind, your vulnerable uncertainty or your vulnerable truth, spreading your legs, opening your arms. Like, it's really the act of revealing, and that definition is the one that is helpful in creating more of it. The focus on the other person seeing you more clearly doesn't really give as many ways forward to create more intimacy, because it's fundamentally a little more passive and it's on the other person to make it happen.
Yeah.
But learning to really reveal yourself in a way that is especially for the person you're intimate with, that's where the passion is created, and that's where the comfort and stability is created as well.
Okay. So going off of that, so it's really about each partner kind of looking within themselves and showing their truth, being authentic, being vulnerable with the other person.
Yes, although as you say that, I'm inclined to adjust what I've said and say that's how you create it, and what it is really the feeling of connection, of closeness and connection that has the unique flavor of intimacy. I know technically you're not supposed to use the word when you define it, but I'm going to go with that because I'm not in an English class right now.
Okay. So getting into your practice, you know, being online, speaking to many different couples across the U.S. or across the world? Do you talk to people across the world?
Yeah, I have clients mostly in the U.S., but all over the world.
Yeah. What are common challenges that couples are facing when it comes to intimacy?
The root of the biggest issue is connected with the most common relationship advice that's given really throughout the Western world and perhaps throughout the whole world. I just don't have reason to know. The most common relationship advice that's given is that you need to learn to compromise. If you want to be happy, compromise is the name of the game. You've got to be good at compromise in order to have a happy, long-lasting marriage. And that is just completely wrong. If what you want is a bland, pleasant companionship, then compromise will definitely deliver that. But if you want long-lasting passion and dynamic, erotic connection, compromise won't do that at all. The way to get there is uncompromising intimacy, which is the name of my book. And in order to understand what that means, if you think of compromise, fundamentally, it is withholding who you are, your desires, feelings, challenges, what's alive inside you, withholding that so that your partner is comfortable. But in the process, you're essentially excising, you're removing parts of yourself and not bringing them into the relationship. And when we put up those little blocks, it creates blocks in our intimacy as well. So where compromise is withholding who you are so that your partner's more comfortable, uncompromising intimacy, fundamentally, it's not about getting your own way, not that sense of uncompromising, but it's about sharing who you really are in a way that your partner can hear it. Learning to say your desires, to express doubts, not that you need to tell your partner everything, but that there isn't anything that you can't say. Because as soon as you can't say it because it will make your partner uncomfortable, you're really disconnecting from yourself in a way that gets in the way of intimacy. So that's the context. And in terms of what I see couples facing, we have an epidemic of conflict-free, passion-free relationships. There definitely are people in volatile, toxic, abusive relationships. But the majority of couples that are together, they get along fine. They want to stay together. There's a lot in life that looks perfectly good from the outside, but it's fairly stale and dehydrated. And that is the natural consequence of compromise.
Mm. So the phrase that I've heard all the time, you know, happy wife, happy life, is not necessarily what you are recommending. You're not recommending to just to do whatever, I mean, if you're talking about, you know, male-female relationship, to just do the male, do whatever is needed for the woman to be happy, because that would be compromising, right?
Exactly. I mean, if you have a happy wife, whatever your gender, if you have a happy wife, you are likely to have a happy life. However, you should not be putting your own needs and desires aside so you have a happy wife, because that's actually not going to cut it. And the place that I encourage couples, you know, if you think of the experience of being in love, and I hope you're still very much in this phase if you got married recently. You know, I've been married 27 years. It's a different thing. But if you think, if you've been married a while and you're listening, you think back, if maybe this is something to look forward to. But regardless, the feeling of being in love is interwoven with a kind of insatiable curiosity. You know, where did you get that scar? And if you weren't a doctor, what profession, you know, what would you like to do? If you didn't live in LA, where would you like to live? If you could have dinner with any celebrity alive or dead, who would it be? And what would you ask them? And what was your favorite vegetable when you were a child? Like, we just have so many questions. We really want to get to know the other person. And then as a relationship develops and we become comfortable, we have familiarity, security, stability, and those are wonderful things. I'm never looking to advise somebody undermines that. But the key is to develop the familiarity and the security without it costing the curiosity and the interest in the other person, because typically there's so much else happening in life. And when we feel a certain familiarity, we tend to stop asking questions because we already know the answers. But if that's the case, I don't recommend stop asking questions. I recommend you find new questions, because whomever you're with is always growing and evolving and having new experiences. And if those aren't brought into the relationship, that's another place that creates a kind of a dullness or a disconnection. And just asking simply, what was the highlight of last week for you, may well be the path to more joy, more intimacy, and literally more sex than not asking that question. I know this sounds like it doesn't sound like a very sexy kind of foreplay, but I've given a lot of talks. I remember one where I was talking about curiosity and how to make a vulnerable communication. There was a woman who was at this conference. She wouldn't have come to my talk, but she was going to the one before. And so she just stayed in the room. She'd been married, I think, 32 years and had a good marriage. And she went home and she asked her husband questions, and she contacted me the next day and said, you know, we didn't have anything wrong, but I just asked some of these basic questions and we had the most amazing conversation. We felt more intimate than we had in about 5 years, and we had really special lovemaking, even though what they were talking about didn't even have anything to do with sex.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. So actually, going back to one of your points that you had earlier, you talked about, you know, uncompromising, which I really like, because I feel like that's a new concept that I have not heard of. I feel like, yeah, so I've been told and even seen past relationships where people are compromising for their relationship, for the other person. How do you advise couples or a person to go about bringing up what they desire or not compromising about a certain thing in one's life?
Yeah, well, I do think that it's really important to practice how you connect with someone and build the emotional intimacy like we're talking about in pretty benign, unimportant arenas. So, you know, like asking questions such as, what was the highlight of your week? You know, something where there's no wrong answer, first of all, which is always true with curious questions. But in particular, it's just not likely that what my spouse or partner is going to say is going to be confronting or complicated for me when they answer that question. Or if you could be president of any country in the world, which one would it be and what policy would you implement? Like, to start with curiosity, where it can be whimsical or serious or religious or philosophical or geographical, like, it doesn't actually matter what. It matters that you're putting the attention on. And when you get in the habit of being open and interested in this way, and let me just add, even if your partner doesn't ask you those same questions, go ahead and give your answer, because it's really changing the culture of how most people communicate. Once you are familiar on these very basic things, like, what's your favorite sunset? Is there any sunset anywhere in the world that you think of and makes you feel good? I mean, that's just a random question. Then when you're used to the kind of open-ended discourse where you don't know where it's going to go, then you can begin to, if you're already at ease with one another, say, is there any sexual fantasy you have that you've never shared with me? But it's not like out of the blue or shocking, because you already have created more curiosity in the culture of how you communicate with one another. That is if you're used to talking about sexual matters. If you're not, actually, before I continue, anything you want to say, or should I go on?
No, I you can continue.
Okay. So the thing is that the vast majority of couples are far more comfortable having sex than talking about sex. So what I just said is, you know, for the more modern, hip, often younger couple that is already talking about sex, then when you expand questions, it's not that big a turn to expand into sexual territory. And you can start, as I said, with asking your partner and then also share your own. But in the more common scenario where a couple is having sex or not having sex, but either way, they're not talking about sex, then it's a question of how to introduce that topic. And so for that, I think it's super important that the first conversations you have are completely separate from sex. They're not in the bedroom. You're both fully clothed. You haven't just had sex. You're not about to have sex. And you also haven't had a fight. You want to have as much relaxation, no stress hormones. You don't have like 10 minutes and then you have to put the kids to bed. You want enough ease. That's the first thing. Second thing is that I highly recommend that you set up the conversation in a way that your partner can opt in. It's like a nuanced way of getting consent. And you can say something like, you know, I have something unusual, or I have something vulnerable, or I have something important that I want to talk about with you. Are you available? And if they say yes, then they've opted in, and that already makes the conversation a little smoother. If they say no, then if you're in a healthy relationship, then the no functions as a not yet. And you can say, okay, well, when would be a good time? And mm-hmm. If someone's asking you and you've heard this, then you can say, not now, but I just want to have some dinner, take a shower, and then I'll be available. You know, you want to make a plan if possible. And then when you're having the conversation, and again, if this is the first time you're having a meaningful conversation about sex or something other than, you know, we need more lube or something like that, that then you start by sharing wonderful moments of sex together. If you've had any great sex with your partner, go ahead and refer to it. You know, that was so amazing when we were in Italy and we did that thing where we were in the alleyway and then we went up to the hotel room, or, you know, I'm making it glamorous just because that's fun, but, you know, it could just be, you know, that night when we saw that movie, and then whatever it is, you want to evoke that experience and share how lovely it was. And for some couples, that is enough to just introduce the topic of sex in a way that doesn't lead to blame, criticism, defensiveness. It's like, I had such a great time with you that night. And that can still be very awkward if you're not used to talking about sex. But that is a place to start, and you can do that often enough. It doesn't typically need to happen that many times, but often enough until it feels like you can pivot into other territory. So you've said, I want to talk about things, or I want have something vulnerable. I want to continue our conversation. Are you available? Your partner says yes. And then you can also say, you know, I really love how we're really aligned with where we live and financial decisions. You support me in my career. I support you in yours. Like, I just think we're such good partners. And I'd really love to bring our sex life up to the same standards. Or you could even say, and I love our sex life, but I feel like there's a little bit more that we could each pay attention to that is really going to make it even better for both of us. I just want to say really clearly, these are all really positive communications. You're getting opt-in from a partner. You're talking about good experiences you've had. If you can't think of a good experience, and think about how nice it is to cuddle while you're on the couch watching a movie, like something that is positive in how you touch one another. Mm-hmm. And then pick some area of your relationship that works. I listed a bunch, but you could just pick one. You know, I love how good we both are to our parents, or whatever it is. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But something that you have in common that already goes well, and then essentially piggyback on that and say, I'd love for our sex life to be as good. And I think we could make some changes so we'd both enjoy it more. And that really sets the stage to then introduce a desire that you haven't said before. So I know that is like a lot of setup, but honestly, it's worth it because it creates a win-win context. And then you can say the thing you want to say with the best chance of it really being heard for the genuine loving desire it is.
Yeah. So what I hear is not overall, but keep it open-ended. Open-ended questions, especially in the beginning, not necessarily about sex or what you want to bring up, but just about other stuff. How was, you know, what was the highlight of your last week, or, you know, what
that's just for more connection. That's
meal,
not
or,
for better sex specifically, but for more connection, which then can lead to better sex.
Yes, and then also bringing up positive aspects of the past, not necessarily saying like, oh, I didn't appreciate when you did this, and kind of starting up a relation or starting up a conversation like that, starting with something more positive and what you enjoyed in your whatever it may be, sex life or finances or pick different parts of your relationship. So the positive parts of it.
Yes, exactly. And as human beings, we're always going to be better at figuring out what isn't working and our complaints. And so even though, you know, it's exactly as you've just said, that it's starting with the positives to make the conversation more successful. When you're essentially talking with yourself, when you're figuring out what you want to say, it could well be, I can't stand when he touches me that way. And if that's the case, no problem. That is a great starting point for noticing what isn't working. However, to the extent that you're able, it's a really good idea to figure out what you do want rather than saying what you don't want. So for example, if you like, he just is too fast. Great. I'm glad you're aware of that. But the thing that's going to really help him is to say, I wish you would be much slower. That gives him something to focus on. Whereas don't be so fast is essentially a negative, unencouraging communication.
Yes. Okay. I get it. Now moving a little bit towards, this fast-paced world we live in with a lot of things to do and schedules and priorities, how can a couple maintain intimacy and connection despite those busy schedules and, you know, other priorities that are out there, competing priorities?
That is, right, the million-dollar question. So I think people often believe that they need more time. If we just had more time together, things would be better. And it can even seem like there's evidence to support that because you have better sex, more connection when you're on vacation, and you have more time together. But really, what is needed is more attention and intention. So I like to give the example of if there's a busy couple, they both have intense careers and one leaves the house first, that person might just leave and get to work because they're focused on what they need to do in the day, or maybe at the door yell out, "Bye, honey, I'm leaving," you know, or go give a peck on the cheek or the mouth and head out. Actually, my husband used to do that and used to drive me crazy because he would like give me a peck, but I would feel like actually his soul was already in the car. It was just his body that happened to be there and it wasn't very satisfying. But what is also an option always, and it only takes like a second or two, is to go be with your partner, take a breath, be present, and go ahead and let your energies merge as you kiss on the lips. Sure, you can have a makeup, but you don't even need to. You can just be with one another. And then when you see one another again at night, it's really a reconnecting. And it's not like you're finding one another again. So that's one thing, that in the course of busy schedules, you don't need huge blocks of time. You just need to be present in your body, landed in your heart when you connect. And that really fuels kind of the energetic matrix of connection that have both people feel supported, seen, cherished, respected, and so forth. Another thing. Yeah. And you don't really see people doing that, right?
No, I don't. Question I was going to ask is about scheduling a date night with, you know, someone, with your partner. Do you recommend that? Do you recommend that in when you advise other couples?
Yeah, you know, I'm not against date nights, but I'm not like a massive diehard date night a week fan either. What I am much more of a fan of is scheduling intimacy, which for most people just sounds like pathetic. You know, it's like it should be spontaneous, it should be fun. How can you have that on your calendar? It's inherently like it goes against the feeling and associations of sexual activities. But I think when you are a grown-ass adult and you have a busy schedule and lots of responsibilities, you know that if you don't schedule working out, it's not likely to happen. If you don't schedule time to cook dinner, then you're going to need to pick up takeout. Like if you want the house clean and you're hiring someone to do it, it has to be scheduled. Like the car doesn't suddenly get serviced. You have to schedule it. And so I really think that our calendars represent our priorities. So I highly recommend scheduling intimacy, scheduling sex. I'm specifically not calling it sex because maybe you'll have sex, maybe you won't, which I'll get into in a second. But if you've never tried it, don't knock it, because it really creates a kind of steady attention. It provides nutrition to the relationship. I do think it's important not to have any pressure that there has to be, well, in a heteronormative context, intercourse or whatever equivalent it would be. Like, it doesn't have to look a particular way. It could be that you just lie in bed naked, spooning, and fall asleep together. Or it could be that you do a massage for one another, or just one of you gives a massage, the other one receives it. And it could be like a regular massage, or it could be a pretty steamy massage. Like it could just be a makeout where like it's understood you're going to have all of your clothes on from the waist down and see what fun you're going to have. Like the point is not that you're scheduling your orgasm. You're not scheduling intercourse. You're scheduling time to relax with one another, time to let your bodies lead, time to get juicy and see what emerges. Because if that isn't scheduled, it's typically the thing that goes by the wayside because sex is never urgent until it's ridiculously urgent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, is this a weekly thing? Is it a daily thing? Is it once a month? I guess it does it just depend on the couple?
Yeah, you know, I'm interested if you have an answer to this, but I don't think of a particular frequency as being normal or necessary. I personally am far more focused on the quality of the sex than the frequency. Although, interestingly enough, when the quality is higher, the frequency is higher too. It stimulates desire. And, you know, I think it also really depends on the couple because my husband and I have had times when it was a practice. And, you know, for 30 days, we'd aim to have sex every day. That's not necessary. That was part of a practice. That was like, we definitely, and I encourage people to treat their relationships as an exploratory research project. And so actually in our case, there's usually something we're working on. It may have to do with sex. It may have to do with other things. It could be, you know, we're working out together. Like there's a bonding that happens when there's something that we have our shared focus on. And so for plenty of couples, once a week, intimacy like this would be a total game changer. And if what you have available is once a month, if, you know, especially if you have two people and they're both on call and it's, or, you know, it's just, you do what you can do. And if scheduling sex or scheduling intimacy is new, I would encourage a couple to start with no more frequent than once a week because it is a little weird and you have to get used to it if it's unfamiliar to look at the calendar and see, oh, next I'm taking my clothes off, you know?
Yeah. But you also said that you don't necessarily have to take your clothes off.
Yes, yes. I was just being
funny.
Intimacy
doesn't mean, yeah, sex. And so it could just be connecting or like asking each other questions or.
Yeah,
yeah,
in
like
fact,
you said, massages, things like
for
that.
For a super busy couple, it may just be enough to have a regular time to sit on the couch and connect with one another with phones down and, you know, no devices, nothing else going on, just facing one another and having a conversation. That might be the more important thing to schedule in the context that you describe where there's so much busyness. And if it sometimes leads to more intimacy and sensuality, great. But it might be the starting point is just to recalibrate.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, there's a question that I have that I feel like comes up a lot in, I mean, even when I see patients, I feel like I've even had the question be asked. Also at conferences that I've been at, it's been addressed. And I would like to see what you want to say or that you would say about it. But the mismatched libido is a big thing. There's usually one partner that wants sex more than the other partner. So what advice do you give to couples in that situation?
I know libido mismatch, it is so trendy as a concept. And I think occasionally it's true, but for the most part, it's just a myth. It's a misconception because, well, if you think of men, there are many men who seem to have low libido, except when they're with a mistress. And then somehow not such an issue. And similarly, women, again, this is more of a heteronormative context, but if a woman is in a 25-year marriage and she's the one with low libido and they get divorced and it's super hard, but within a year, her libido is like off the charts. She is having the time of her life. And so those are just ways to illustrate this point, but fundamentally, I think that when someone has low libido, it is at least very likely that they're not having the kind of sex that they would want more of. I was going to say they're not having the kind of sex they want, but often a woman in this situation hasn't ever had the kind of sex that she would want more of. So she doesn't know there's anything more for her to want. So in terms of libido mismatch, I tend to find it much more useful to talk about spontaneous desire and responsive desire, where spontaneous desire is physiologic desire. Like the ultimate example is, you know, a 16-year-old boy who, whenever he thinks about sex, he's ready to have it. And that kind of desire, we can have that, but many busy people don't have that all of the time. They only have that a small amount of the time. And instead, what they have is responsive desire, where our desire and our arousal is related to things in our environment in terms of the quality of emotional connection with our partner, whether the sheets have been changed and the bed made, whether the kitchen is cleaned up, whether the kids are asleep, whatever circumstances impede the relaxation and intimacy. When those are attended to, then desire rises. So basically, if a couple is navigating what the symptoms that would be described as libido mismatch, I think it's really the responsibility of both partners to consider what are the things that would stimulate responsive desire in the so-called low libido partner. Does she want rose petals on the bed and music and flowers? Well, if that's the case, rather than complaining her libido is low, or the woman thinking there's something wrong with her, make a point of having rose petals on the bed and music and candles. Or, and you know, it's stereotypically the woman, and that is certainly very common, but I'm coaching a couple right now, a man and a woman, and when, no matter what their relationship flavor is, they could be having a fight or kind of numb or whatever, disconnected, and she's ready to have sex, and he's like, no, like, mm-hmm. He doesn't want to go there unless they feel emotionally connected first. And so that's his responsive desire. And most people have some combination of spontaneous and responsive desire, and I really think that is more useful and more solution oriented than libido mismatch as a kind of static state, when really it's much more dynamic.
Yeah. Okay.
What do you think?
No, I was making sure that I understood what you were saying. But I do believe that life also changes, and, you know, bodies change, and hormones change in bodies, you know, women, menopause. And usually that is the point of women not necessarily wanting sex as much, because their bodies change and so forth. But I say that to say that I feel like it's ebbs and flows, like libido ebbs and flows. So yes, I do agree that it's not a static something, that it is something that continually moves. And sometimes women, if we say that they're usually the ones with low libido, that doesn't necessarily have to be the case all of the time.
Yeah. And specifically in terms of being postmenopausal and menopausal, I think one of the underappreciated realities is that we often don't want or don't respond to the sex we were having when we were younger in the same way. So the sex that works at 35 and 40, that at 50 and 60, rather than not having sex, I think it's really valuable for both partners to discover, okay, what kind of sex is going to be really pleasurable? Because, you know, the data is clear that women's sexuality peaks in our 60s and 70s. It does not peak. It does not conclude with menopause. And mm-hmm. on my podcast, the Intimate Marriage Podcast, I interviewed a couple. It was such a great conversation. They've been married for 51 years, and she was saying her orgasms just keep getting better and better. And that has to do with her putting her attention on her pleasure and learning to experience more. I my Facebook profile doesn't exist anymore because I was hacked. It was disconnected. But I used to have a Facebook group, and there was a woman who joined who, they've been married for 53 years. She said they'd always had a strong sex life, and 3 years before had a sexual awakening where everything got so much more fiery. And sure, there is human variation. You know, we have different anatomy, we have different biographies, we have different trauma. Like, there is a lot of variation. Just because something can happen for one person doesn't guarantee it for another. But I really think that so much more is possible and sometimes happens behind closed doors than we know about, because the typical conversation is that with menopause, we just dry up. Yeah. And while that is common, I think it doesn't need to be anywhere near as frequently as it occurs.
The not having sex or the not having sex,
yeah. Feeling like it's not as fun, and all of that coming under not the only contributing factors, but all of that coming under the umbrella of low libido also.
Yeah. Yeah. And then also to address the question that I asked earlier about mismatched libido, do you think it is also up to the partner who doesn't necessarily, or doesn't have the highest libido or has lower libido in the comparison, for them to speak up for their desires and fantasies and things that they want to see happen in their sex life?
You know, it would be easy to say yes, it'd be easy to say no. And the fact is, in my experience, in any couple, usually one is more proactive. And it really doesn't matter which one, as long as someone is opening up the space and creating room for dialogue. So if you're listening and you're the high libido partner and you're the one who can bring this conversation up and make it safe and indicate how much you care and that you're a willing collaborator in discovering what's going to work, well, go for it. Don't assign the job of bringing that up to the low libido partner. But if you're the low libido partner, then definitely explore yourself and share with your partner that you're committed to discovering what's going to work. Because what often happens is, rather than more communication, there ends up being less, because the low libido partner feels like there's something wrong with her and the high libido partner feels profoundly rejected, and it gets so complicated and any communication becomes more just filled with landmines. Mm-hmm. And so whoever has the capacity to shift the dialogue between the two of them, go for it. If you have that to offer, don't withhold that gift to your marriage.
Yeah, I like that. So starting to wrap things up, getting to the question of what advice do you have for couples who may be hesitant to seek professional help for their intimacy issues? So the mismatched libido, or just lack of communication. What advice do you give them to if they're hesitant to seek that advice?
Okay, well, first of all, if you're hesitant to seek that advice and you get to the point where you're comfortable, I guarantee that at that point you will wish you sought help earlier. So I don't know that that makes it any easier to seek help, but this is an area that we tend to think we should know how to do. And there are many of us, you and me and many others, who are devoted to facilitating more pleasure, more comfort, more ease, more joy in this arena. So there's no benefit not to tapping into that. However, if you have resistance, then I recommend that you listen to podcasts, you read books, you grow your comfort with the conversation topics in the privacy of your own home. You know, you can get a book and put a false cover on it so no one knows you're reading it. You can listen to podcasts and nobody knows what you're listening to. And I think the most helpful way out of the kind of trap of shame in seeking help or resistance in seeking help is just to hear other people's stories. And so any podcast or books that's going to include stories is going to make it easier to then take the next step and Google, or if you have friends, you can ask and just start getting a feeling for who offers services that you might want to partake of. And I think in every profession, there are some bad apples, but basically, in general, anyone who's going to help with libido and sexuality and confidence in the bedroom and ease and pleasure, they are someone who genuinely wants to help you. Whether or not they can, that's a different subject, but they are going to want to help you. And just remember that every step of the way until you complete your first appointment.
Okay. So this leads to the question of how can people stay in contact with you and work with you or read your book, Uncompromising Intimacy, right?
Yeah, what an elegant transition. Okay, so my website is alexandrastockwell.com, and that's a good place to go if you'd like to contact me, follow up on anything we've talked about. You can find the links to all of my social media. You can download the first chapter of my book, Uncompromising Intimacy, or get the whole thing if you like. You can listen to my podcast, the Intimate Marriage Podcast, and any of my programs or private coaching. It's all at alexandrastockwell.com.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Alexandra, for being on the podcast and imparting such wisdom about communication and intimacy in long-term relationships. I feel like I've definitely been writing notes down, and I hope you out there have been too, because this has been a very helpful conversation.
Thank you so much. And Dr. Kara, I think this podcast provides such an important service, so I'm honored to be a part of it.
And thank you out there for joining us on today's podcast. You are listening to the Viva La Vulva podcast. Bye.